From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that is accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware-Peak. And this morning we kick things off by speaking with local hydrologist Brian McInerney, who will talk with us about this crazy snowpack that hopefully in the last couple of days has reached its apex, which is kind of hard to say and to fathom. He'll talk to us about all of the potential runoff scenarios.
Then Tanya Lewis, senior health and medicine editor at Scientific American, explores new research on the origins of COVID-19. Stay tuned to hear how scientific evidence is pointing towards the raccoon dog as the culprit. Also, some new findings about long COVID.
These guests, when we return, you're listening to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
Today is maybe the first day we can say spring might actually be on the way. And it really turns out all our thoughts to what could be the most significant runoff in recent history are starting to appear. Our next guest is Brian McInerney, a longtime hydrologist with the National Weather Service and frequent guest on KPCW. And while he is now retired and probably enjoying a lot of skiing this winter, we brought him in because we know he keeps a keen eye on what the runoff scenarios could be this spring and even into summer. Brian McInerney, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate being here.
So first off, there have been so many comparisons between this year and the big runoff of 1983. Can you give us a little bit of a compare and contrast to what we were looking at in 83 as opposed to what we have now?
Yeah, if we compare and look to 83, what you find is 1983 was a somewhat average year for most of the winter. The difference was it just kept going. It kept snowing, it was cold all the way through April into May. And then at somewhere around mid-May, late May, the switch flipped, the sun came out, the storms went away, and we had melt at low, mid, and high elevations all at once. The snowpack was ripe, it was ready to go, and it produced a phenomenal amount of peak flow during that time. And it really had to do with the spring weather. It just kept snowing, it was cold, it didn't let up.
So one thing I was listening to another hydrologist talk about this was saying that back then, especially 81, 82, 83, we'd had big snow years, so the groundwater, the water tables were fairly high and basically filled, if you will. Are we looking at that this year, or do we maybe have a space underground for a lot of this water to melt?
So when you look at 83, if you go back to the fall before the winter started, they had a hurricane, a decaying hurricane that moved up into Utah and produced about 7 inches of rain. And it saturated the soils. And then everything just was in stasis through the winter. It didn't really freeze up, maybe a little bit in the fall. And then it just stayed there. So when it came time to melt late in the month with that in May, it just came off. There was nowhere to go. It was like a full sponge. Look at this year. We've had multiple years of dry, hot weather that have produced very dry soils. So when you look at the forecast for how much snow we have, and we're about 200% of median at the higher elevations, the forecast for the volume of water expected to come out of the mountains is roughly about 140 to 150%, 1.5 times. And that's due to the dry soils, because the model, how it works, looks at what do we know right now? We know the snowpack right now, and we know the soil moisture. And then we put 30 years of weather into the model and run it 30 times to come up with all these different scenarios. And then we take the middle 50% and say, that's most likely what you're gonna get. And what will you, if you look at this area around Park City, we're going to get about 150% volume runoff from April 1st through the end of July. The thing that is a little different, a little scary on two fronts, is that our low elevation snow is 200 to 300%. What you see at 6,500 feet at my house or the base area of the ski area and in town, we are just bombed with snow. There is snow everywhere. That's that low elevation snow. That's going to start coming off with this weather we have this week, and it's much needed. We need to get some of this low elevation snow off, and that's what we're going to see.
Okay, so, well, if you're joining us now, it's we're speaking with Brian McInerney. He is a now retired hydrologist, but for 30 years or more, he worked with the National Weather Service, and we had him in here at KBCW regularly to talk about all of these things. So, of course, when I thought about runoff, I just thought that we would need to speak with you, especially because when I hear you talk about things like debris flows and that sort of thing, it really turns my thought to what's going on underneath the snowpack. And so I'm wondering if, you know, to what degree, you know, our, I guess you could say our winter started about, what, November 1st or something, when it started and then it never went away. In that time, was there any great saturation before the ground froze? Like, what happens in that intermediate stage until the ground freezes?
So in the past, before we warmed our climate, you know, around 1980 somewhere and earlier than that, the fall months were really cold, you know, 30, 40 degrees below zero in the mountains. It froze up the soil. But since we are warming, we really don't see the ground freezing. It's just about 0 degrees centigrade. And that is, if we went out and dug a snow pit and looked down at the bottom, that's probably what you'd see, 0 degrees centigrade. During the winter, in December and November, we had some very intense rainfall. And that saturated the snowpack to the point where it was isothermal. It was 0 degrees centigrade from the top of the snowpack to the bottom. It was an early snowpack, but when I took a professional level avalanche course, and we dig snow pits, and you'd find it was isothermal, which I have never seen before. It was, you had to sit back and think, what am I looking at here? And it was because we had so much rain, it infiltrated the shallow snowpack, and then that snowpack was actually pretty stable, and then we added to it, and we really haven't stopped. And that has brought us to where we are right now. So there's parts of the snowpack that had just dense snow that's in there. What it's going to have to do when it melts, it's going to go into the soils and then occupy that pore space in the soils to a certain degree before we start really seeing bigger runoff. And that's where we're at right now. We're starting this process with this warm weather coming up.
That's really interesting. Yeah, up to this point, we really have had very little runoff. We haven't had warm days. And even though we're sort of looking outside and rejoicing that there's blue sky, it was 9 degrees where I was this morning. And so we're talking about a warming, but this isn't a really significant warming. This would just be sort of average temperatures for this time of year, right? So it's not going to produce that huge flooding right away in the next week, right?
No. This is just the start of the process. When you have a snowpack that's 200% of median, as we see right now, that snowpack has a lot of energy that needs to be taken out of it before it can produce meltwater. We typically see peak flows from the major river systems around here in about late May, early June. That's going to be pushed back a little bit unless this spring weather gets incredibly hot. When you have the biggest energy input into the snowpack, which is solar radiation, this time of year, the angle of the sun is still quite low compared to what it would be in, you know, the summer equinox. Or the summer solstice. And so it can't get enough energy in the snowpack to make it isothermal and to produce widespread flooding. What you'll see with this warm-up is we'll see smaller streams starts picking up as the low elevation snow reaches that isothermal conditions. And then that is going to start the process. We need to warm right now. We don't want to replicate 1983's scenario of a late season snow all the way through April and into May. And at that point, the sun's energy is quite high in the sky, and you can put a lot of energy into that snowpack and melt it, make it isothermal, and then produce very high peak flow runoffs. We know we're going to get a high volume. It depends on how this is going to come off.
Well, I'm looking around at the mini ice age that's forming around our condos because we've been shoveling so much snow off of the roof like we have in off every building in town. And it creates these very, very dense snowpacks, like behind the house. And again, small glaciers are forming. Is that, how can we expect those to melt? And are these big piles of snow that we that have accumulated from basically shoveling off all of our roofs, do we need to pay special attention to them?
I think what we need to look at is just the widespread snowpack at this elevation. If you look around on south-facing aspects, north-facing, and down to maybe 6,000 feet, if you have snow all around there, and we have 300% of median right now, when you look at some of the low elevation monitoring stations, that snow today is going to start ripening in a quick fashion. It's going to start producing meltwater, and we're going to see a pickup in the small rivers and streams. The Provo, the Weber, the bigger rivers, that's going to take quite a while. But small streams around town are going to pick up. And what we don't want, and which I think is the most fearful for me, is that with a warming climate, we could see very intense warm rainfall sometime in this month and next month. And when that happens, that can be a wild card, a game changer. You can have an orderly melt and then have a period of 3 days of heavy, intense, warm rain, and then that just picks peak flows up massively. And that's where you'll see problems. I think this year, with your analogy of this, the snow around your house, we're going to see a lot of basement flooding. Things we need to look at is sump pumps. Does your sump pump work? Also, in the small channels around town, is it full of junk? Is it full of debris? We need to clean that out, because that's another game changer. If the culverts get clogged, then it jumps and hits the roads, and then it's looking for a new channel, which could be somebody's house. And that's a problem.
Well, you talk about all the water flowing from here down the valley, down into the streams, the rivers, and with the Salt Lake Valley still being frozen as well. Do you know what these lower level river systems and catch basins are doing to prepare for all of this extra water coming in?
Yeah, I've talked to Salt Lake County. I've been working with them, or Salt Lake City in some extent, and they have had a lot of engineering improvements. They're ready for it. It's not like 1983, where just the slightest hiccup in the engineering would cause massive flooding. They've done a pretty good job of clearing things out and widening channels, underground systems. They feel like they can handle some of this, but it's that rain event that's a worrisome. Now, when we get into late May, we're going to start seeing the bigger rivers pick up, and that's where you'll see out-of-bank flows, raging rivers, the Weber, the Provo. They're just going to go big. And we should fill our reservoirs this time of year, you know, this year, compared to what we had in the past. But most likely this year is a one-off. We're going to go back to high pressure as the dominant weather feature for our winters, and that's unfortunate. That's why this year, if it was going to snow, it was time to get after it and go skiing, because this is most likely we're only going to see this, you know, as a one-off. And then we're going to go back to warm, dry winters with high pressure dominating the western U.S. It's just, it was in the research when we looked at this, that you would have long periods of high pressure interspersed by intense weather that we saw this year.
Mm. So there is no model that shows this will be the new normal, as everyone's hoping for.
No, unfortunately, when you look at 1980 and then you move the time forward, high pressure used to be about 1980. You know, we'd see it for about 2 weeks in January. And then in northern Utah, the storms were on a regular basis, and it was great. It was Utah snow, and it was what we wanted. Moving forward, as the atmosphere warms, high pressure now can last up to 2 months, maybe even prolonged into 3 months, with little wiggles in the system producing small amounts of snow. We're going to go back into this, and I think all you have to do is look at Lake Powell, Lake Mead, to see how our water system is doing. I think Lake Powell was at 25%. All of the reservoirs will pick up. This will be a nice year to recharge these. But don't anticipate this will be a regular feature. We're going to go back to drought, unfortunately, because this was so fun. It was a blast of a winter. When you think of how many powder days we had this year, it was. And being retired, I didn't have to go to work. I just went skiing all the time. It was great.
We're so happy for you.
Thank you.
Okay, I want to understand this a little bit. A bit ago, you were talking about solar radiation and how we're not close enough to the solstice to have it be really affecting. However, I've noticed since the spring equinox that even when it's been cold and snowing a lot, at my house, you know where I am, at about 9,000 feet, we saw that the snow, you know, because shoveling has been our activity. You've been skiing, we've been shoveling. And I've noticed that the snow has not been able to stick around as long. And I think it's just because we have that much more sunlight. So I'm kind of curious about that. So even when it's cold and you still have a long hours of solar radiation, it must be doing something.
Yeah, it is. It's getting better. When we were in the dry years, when I was actually working, what we would worry about was an early melt in March. And when that would happen, you would have just periods of warm days, but then it would get cold at night. And then you wouldn't have a 24-hour melt cycle. And so during that time, you would start losing your snow water equivalent. But now we look at it, we're getting into 24-hour melt cycles, and that's a problem if you're gonna worry about flooding.
Like I said, 9 degrees this morning, it's still not quite a 24-hour melt cycle, which is good.
Yeah.
Although we do have to be careful because it melts during the day and then whatever's left on the ground freezes at night. As we watch these temperatures warm over the weekend, what is there a temperature threshold at which we need to start worrying during the day?
It can get really hot during the day, but the snowpack is like a puffy coat. It has great insulation. You need bright sunshine, and that'll help you. Once you start noticing Park City getting a 24-hour melt cycle, meaning it doesn't get below 32 degrees, then we're okay. And then it'll start melting on a regular basis. We can pull this low elevation snow off and we'll be okay.
So I've been talking with people about, again, the mini ice ages behind all of our houses, and some have said to dig channels along the side of the snow pile between your house and the snow pile. Will that be effective to help the runoff, the melt, flow into a different direction besides your basement?
Well, the problem is you might channel it into your neighbor's house.
Okay.
And we had so many
which
people.
Which would be better.
But I think that's the case, is people try and engineer their own property only to shunt the water down to your neighbor's property. If you can kind of put it into an existing channel, that's good. But making a channel to your neighbor's house is probably not good for long-time resident
relationships.
Happiness. Relationships, right? But I think this weather pattern that we're going to see this week is really what we need. This is a warming. It's going to start ripening. It'll take it off. Then our mindsets will be in, how's your sump pumps? How's the basement? Check it frequently, because groundwater levels are going to start to rise. We do have a large deficit, though, with dry soils. So a lot of this snow is going to infiltrate in. And then if we get warm winds, then that'll ablate a lot of this snow. But my worry is, are we going to have a warm, wet cycle for about 3 or 4 days with heavy, intense rainfall? And that could be problematic in a big way.
So if we were to get that heavy, warm rain, where does it go? Does it filter down through the snowpack, make it to the ground, and then affect the snowpack by decaying it from underneath? Or does it just sort of take off the top layers?
If you have a snowpack that's 200% of average, which is what we're looking at right now, and we had a large rain on this, what it does, it hits the snow, and that warm raindrop will go into a very cold snowpack, and then that will warm the snowpack. Depending on how much rain you get, how much heat goes into that snowpack, if it can get to isothermal conditions and melt that snowpack down to the ground, now you've melted that snow, and now you've produced an additional inch, maybe 2 inches, depending on how hard it's raining, on a snowpack that's melting at about 2 inches per day. Wow. The channels that you see throughout Utah are formed by flows they've seen for thousands of years. They just form over time. When you put excessive amounts of rain and runoff at the same time, it exceeds that channel capacity. And that's when you have problems. Add on to that, we've built homes right next to streams that looks really nice, but they're gonna get hammered if we see this scenario play out. If it warms nice like this, we don't get into the 24-hour melt cycle for another month, we'll have high volume flows, but the peak flows will stay lower.
So now's the first time we actually need to wait for warming temperatures. Normally in the spring, we're like, bring it on, but now we get to wait a little bit. a lot of people, this is a huge year. We're happy for that. We're refilling some of the reservoirs. How can we convince people that this is just an anomaly? This is a one-off, because people will start to see reservoirs are full, the Salt Lake is saved. But like you're saying, this isn't the new norm. What can we say to people to convince them and remind them that we're still, the climate is changing, we're facing more and more droughts, and this isn't something that we can expect every year?
This is a hard subject. Even when I was working, I found this was discouraging, because if you look at the science on climate change, you know, and warming, 98% or more of the scientists that do this research that publish in accredited journals say it's happening, we're causing it. And this was science that was done in the 90s, and it was well received. And it's something that, like, okay, this is the science. Let's now address it, and how are we going to deal with it? And what happened was the oil and the coal and the gas industry put a spin on it and politicized it, very similar to the cigarette makers back when in the 50s. Cigarettes are good for you. You should buy them. But actually, they kill people. But it's so profitable, the way we do our economy, that those entities basically said it's not happening, don't worry about it. So my job as the hydrologist, and also in the early 90s, I was the climate change scientist, so I went and learned about all the climate science. It was pretty evident, and the people that were going to be affected first were the farmers and the ranchers. And they just didn't seem to want to believe it. They were kind of, this guy's just, you know, making this up, and it's not true. And no matter what kind of data I would put out there and talk about the science, it just didn't seem to resonate with them. And now they're in these positions where their farms and ranches are incredibly dry, things are hard to grow, and they're going to lose their farms and ranches because there won't be water for this. And that was part of the reason why I retired. I found that was so discouraging, that this message that I felt needed to get out, and people really needed to embrace this for their own good and for the good of our community, was just being pushed aside. Or we would have a panel discussion at the Kimball Arts Center, and it was very festive. It was on climate change, and we were gonna, some young people were there gonna recycle Starbucks cards, cups. And it was very festive, and they got to me, and I just laid out the science as to how bad this is going to get, and how there's really, we've passed the tipping points. And they were like, oh, the old crabby old guy, who let this guy in? And unfortunately, the science of what I laid out there was really just the surface of what's going to happen with this. And you could see people are like, well, someone will invent something to fix all this. And if you really look deep down in the science, we're not going to get out of this. It's going to keep getting warmer, keep getting drier. Weather's going to get more wild. For instance, every degree centigrade you raise the temperature, you increase the atmospheric moisture by 7%. So now we've raised the temperatures, the atmosphere can hold more moisture. We get way more storms that are much more intense. That's where that warm rain this spring comes in.
Right. So I'm wondering, let's move into a little bit of talk about debris flows and what we may see. And I only call them debris flows because that's what you've called them over the years when I've interviewed you. So we could talk about mudslides and landslides and things like that. I've been a couple of times down to southern Utah this spring, and see down there even that, you know, such a dry place, you know, around the Zion area, they've gotten so much precipitation, both in rain and snow this year, that the moisture, the soil is absolutely saturated, and it's so muddy everywhere. Of course, it dries out quickly, but wondering what you see in this area, and where are the areas that we're going to need to watch out for in Summit County, where, you know, we may have a steep slope. I don't know. Are you worried about that at all?
I think what we saw with debris flows, at least when I was working, was the result of a burn scar, a wildfire that would happen, burn the vegetation off, cook the soil so it was hydrophobic. It didn't allow water to infiltrate. Anytime you've had a hot burn, on a steep slope, most likely you're going to get debris flows for about 4 years. It takes that long for the vegetation to regrow. I think with Park City and the surrounding areas, the areas that had burns within the last 4 years are going to be problematic for debris flows. But I think the rest of it, since we've had such dry soils, I don't really worry about that. 1983 had that hurricane that produced 7 inches of rain in October at the start of 1983's water year. This year, we went into this very dry. So debris flows most likely will not be an issue unless we get that warm rain 3-4 days or longer. Then we'll see. That changes things.
Okay, very interesting. And then in terms of atmospheric rivers, you know, and the possibility of a warm rain, when does the atmospheric rivers disappear in the season? I mean, or is every indication pointing towards us indeed having a warm rain?
They used to, the atmospheric rivers used to be a winter phenomenon, and you would see them as the high pressure would break down. It would go down by Baja. High pressure rotates clockwise. Then you would have a low pressure up near Canada rotating counterclockwise. And if you can perceive that, the two spinning weather features, it's like the ball in a pitching machine where you have one rotating clockwise on the bottom part, one rotating counterclockwise. The ball gets shot through the middle. That's where you get atmospheric rivers. It pulls that low-level moisture that's phenomenally moist from Hawaii and kind of shoots it right into the West Coast and then into over the Sierras and into Utah. That phenomenon breaks down in the wintertime as the whole pattern shifts. And then what you get is the monsoon flow, which really isn't a true monsoon. It's just moisture starts coming up from Baja into the southern U.S. When you're in transition and with a warming climate, the atmospheric rivers are actually lasting longer into the spring. So we really don't want another atmospheric river because it'll come in warmer, and that's when we'll see that intense rainfall over a period of time.
Well, it is going to be very interesting the next couple of months. And Brian McInerney, local hydrologist, retired hydrologist, but I hear it's good in retirement to keep your brain active. And so we'd love to have you back on in a few months to
All
talk
right.
about.
It's getting dusty as I'm just goofing around.
Great. Thanks so much for coming in. And
absolutely.
Great information. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Well, we haven't talked on this show recently about COVID, so it's time for an update. Our next guest is Senior Health Editor at Scientific American, Tanya Lewis. Tanya joins the show to talk about the recent findings that point to more conclusive evidence as to the origins of COVID. Scientists have uncovered new genetic evidence from the market in Wuhan, China, where COVID cases first clustered in late 2019. Tanya joins to talk about that and also about some other interesting findings about COVID, long COVID, that is. Tanya Lewis, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much for having me. It's always great to be with you.
Well, we haven't talked to you for a long time, and you know, it's interesting that information still is coming sort of in waves about COVID. But as soon as I saw the possible spillover from a raccoon dog in Wuhan, I knew I needed to talk to you about this. So first of all, what is a raccoon dog, and how were they being sold in the market? This was one of my questions. Is it live or dead as pet or food?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So raccoon dogs are actually not related to raccoons. They're actually more closely related to foxes. So they're small, you know, canid, like dog-like animals. And they are known to be traded in China. So They are raised, I believe, both for their fur and for their meat. So it's actually not clear whether or not these animals were live animals or not. But we know that there was earlier evidence. People had taken photos in the market and shown that there were live raccoon dogs. So this is just kind of even more powerful evidence that these animals were being sold at the market. in the same places where they found positive COVID samples. So basically, or the virus itself, SARS-CoV-2. Mm-hmm. So that's just even stronger evidence that they were in the same place at the same time and may have transmitted the virus to humans.
This was a very early theory, and this is what I love about science, is that you don't just theorize and then call it fact. You actually study it and research it. But, you know, it's 3 years later. So can you talk to us about the research that has gone on since it was first theorized?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, as we know, this virus first started circulating sometime in late 2019. We're not sure exactly when, but some of the earliest cases may have been as early as November of 2019. And many of these early cases have been tied to this Wuhan seafood market. It doesn't just sell seafood, but that was just the name. And they, you know, this was a plausible hypothesis because we know that in the past, viruses have jumped to humans from animals at these types of markets. That's how the first SARS virus first infected a human was believed to be at one of these markets. Chinese researchers led by the Chinese CDC went in early 2020 and they swabbed lots of parts of this market and they took all these genetic samples to test for COVID. But unfortunately, a lot of that data has sort of been kept sealed and the public was not really able to get access to it and other scientists weren't able to analyze the data. And so it was only earlier this year in early March, this Chinese team had uploaded some of these genetic sequences that they had gathered from the market, this database that scientists have access to. And a researcher in France actually spotted this data and immediately alerted her colleagues and they started analyzing it. And they found, that's when they found evidence of not only raccoon dog DNA, but also DNA from many other animals that were likely being sold at the market. And any of these animals could have been a potential source of the virus. So that data was posted online. It was later removed and it's not clear exactly why. The researchers in China, I believe, are trying to get their work published. But the international community has really spoken out strongly in favor of releasing this data. And in the last week or so, the Chinese team did actually re-release this data. And it does show exactly what this team suspected, which is that these data contained raccoon dog DNA and in parts of the market that were all clustered around where they found a lot of the samples, which was the southwest corner of the market. So that's kind of suggestive that, you know, we, although it's not the same as saying that we found an infected animal, that would be kind of like, you know, the smoking gun, or as one of my sources said, the smoking raccoon dog. They didn't find that, but it's often very difficult to find the actual animal itself who was infected. And one of the, you know, sort of challenges is that they were doing this sampling about a month or so after some of those earliest cases. So it's actually would have been challenging to find the animal that may have been infected initially.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're talking with Tanya Lewis, a senior editor at Scientific American who covers health and medicine. So Tanya, why is the raccoon dog being singled out as a possible source for the origins?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the reason for that is partly because they found so much raccoon dog DNA right in those samples where that were testing positive for COVID. For the COVID virus. But the other reason is that raccoon dogs are known to be susceptible to COVID. We know they can get infected. It's less known how well they actually transmit the virus to others, but that's something that's actively being researched. But we know, you know, there are some animals that are more susceptible to COVID than others, and raccoon dogs are one of the ones that are definitely susceptible.
So back in 2003, there was the original SARS outbreak that we know of, which killed 774 people in a short amount of time, and that came from civet cats. Have scientists and researchers learned anything new about this zoonotic jumping since then that they've been able to utilize for this research?
Yeah, so actually it took more than a decade for scientists to trace the source of SARS-1. And although civet cats, you're absolutely right that that was sort of the intermediate host that gave it to humans, we were actually able to trace the original source back to bats, specifically horseshoe bats. And it's believed that SARS-CoV-2, the one that causes COVID, is also most likely found in bats, but we haven't yet been able to find exactly the same virus circulating in bats. So that's kind of, it gave scientists an idea, you know, when they found the SARS-1 virus in bats, that this is a place to look for coronaviruses. And bats carry many other viruses as well, but this type of zoonotic spillover is very common. And in fact, most or many of the past pandemics have been caused by viruses jumping from animals into humans.
We heard about all of the lockdowns in China once COVID hit in a big way. And it's so interesting how they're able to so closely regulate what their humans are doing in terms of coming and going in and out of their houses. Where is the regulation in China, you know, at markets like this?
Yeah, I mean, that's an absolutely reasonable, question to ask. And I think certainly, I believe after the first SARS outbreak, there was a bit of a clampdown on this type of, you know, wildlife trading. But unfortunately, I think, China's such a big country and the wildlife trade is kind of by its nature very difficult to regulate. A lot of these animals are, you know, maybe endangered or possibly being raised illegally. So it's kind of difficult to trace all of the sources of these animals. But that said, you know, after this, you know, when they first suspected that maybe this Wuhan market was involved in spreading SARS-CoV-2, China did, you know, basically announce that they would shut down all trading of animals sold for meat. But as you mentioned earlier, you know, animals can be sold for fur as well, and also for traditional Chinese medicine. And I believe that those, you know, types of wildlife uses are still allowed. So it's unfortunately, I think the case that we still are going to have these types of animals being traded. But the more we can do to kind of regulate that, the better, I think.
Mm-hmm. What is the type of regulation that is coming, knowing that this spillover happened and could easily happen again for the next version of the SARS virus?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, it's really difficult to regulate these types of things internationally, right? I mean, every country basically has to say, we're going to crack down on this stuff and try to prevent the sale of live animals, wildlife specifically. Although domestic animals can also be a source of viral outbreaks, as we've been seeing with a lot of the bird flu cases that have been infecting chickens, for example. But in general, I think all countries need to be more strict about the conditions in which these animals are being raised and traded and kept. You know, I mean, if we're keeping them in small cages in very close proximity to humans and other animals, that's just a recipe for a pandemic to start, because you've got viruses mixing in different animals and, you know, lots of bodily fluids being exchanged and stuff. So I think it's just another reminder that we really cannot ignore these animal markets and farms as well.
So you also have a podcast called Your Health Quickly. And last week you did a great episode on long COVID and its roots in the brain, which I think is so pertinent to so many people. My nephew, who is 30, has had long COVID since last February, and he's still struggling with it. And to read through your podcast or listen to your podcast discussing it with a 23-year-old who still has problems to this day, they're starting to discover more and more that COVID is also a neurological disorder. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'm really sorry for your nephew, because I think this is something that unfortunately millions of Americans are struggling with long COVID. And it's, you know, that's going to be with us much longer than the pandemic itself. So the story that we covered on the podcast was actually a feature. It was a feature article in our print magazine by Stephanie Sutherland. And basically it looked at how many of these long COVID symptoms, which you know, can range across all different parts of the body. Many of them are actually, it turns out, tied to the brain and nervous system. So we think in some cases it's possible that the virus itself is, you know, making its way into brain cells or neurons. And in other cases, it may be more indirect through sort of inflammation that's happening in the brain, which can then cause many of these like other symptoms such as brain fog and fatigue and, you know, just headaches and all kinds of other symptoms that really don't seem related on the surface. But when you really dig into it, a lot of them have this neurological origin.
I've noticed a correlation between age and long COVID, but maybe that's just who I've been speaking with. Are there more younger people, especially healthy younger people, that are getting long COVID symptoms?
I'm not sure if more younger people are getting it, but certainly young people can get long COVID. I think the, you know, many of the people that are affected are in their sort of, you know, 40s or so, but it can really affect any age. So, you know, the thing about long COVID is that there isn't just sort of one typical long COVID patient. That's what makes it so challenging to study. But it's certainly true that many people who have had, you know, relatively minor infections do report these lingering symptoms. So I think the risk is slightly higher if you've had a very severe case, but that doesn't mean that, you know, you have to have had a severe case in order to have long COVID.
Right. It sounds like, at least from what you said in your podcast, that it sort of depends on where the virus lodges itself in your nasal passages, for example. So yeah, that suggests that maybe if you don't even have a strong case of it, but if the virus is lodged there in your nasal passage quite deep, it sounds like, you know, if it is adjacent to neurons, then that can create a huge problem because of sort of this attack that your body does, your immune system does on the invading microbes, but it can also affect those neurons, as you say. Is this also what they're seeing?
Yeah, no, I think that it's totally true that the nasal passages obviously are very closely connected to the brain. So anything that affects, you know, that infects you in your nasal passages could potentially, you know, affect the brain. Now there is the blood-brain barrier that sort of prevents a lot of things from getting in, but we have seen in a few cases evidence of people who have died from COVID, you know, and they've looked at their brains and there were some infected brain cells. So it's certainly possible the virus is directly infecting the brain. But yes, it could also be this sort of cascade of inflammation that's triggered when your own body's immune system kind of reacts to the virus and overreacts. And what you end up getting are all of these sort of other, you know, unrelated symptoms. Well, I guess they are related, but unrelated to the initial infection. And then they just, some people believe that the virus itself is lingering in the body in some cases. And so perhaps, you know, for those people, we just need to, you know, keep giving them antivirals and vaccines and things like that. But for right. others, it's not clear why they still have symptoms well after they've recovered.
Right. So it's a question of it either being the virus is still in you or the effects mm-hmm. of your own body, your body's immune system attacking what it thinks is the virus, but is actually attacking your neurological system.
Yeah.
So, and that was the story of this young man. I think he was 23 or 24, Ibrahim, who basically lost his ability to walk correctly and had to use a wheelchair for a while. That was sort of a first that I had heard of in terms of long COVID. Yeah, is that unusual for all the COVID cases that you have studied?
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly not directly an expert on long COVID, but I think, you know, it is rare for this to, I mean, I think in many cases, people have had issues with balance. So maybe the problem wasn't so much necessarily being unable to walk, but more being unable to properly balance. And, you know, there's so many, you know, your nervous system is involved in so many different things. And one of those things is sort of maintaining your control over your limbs and your balance. And I think that is one of the things that can be, affected by long COVID.
One of the things that Ibrahim talks about in your podcast is that people got tired of listening to him talk about how poorly he felt and how he gets so frustrated that people stop believing him. So he started an app called Strong Haulers. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so he actually has been involved in kind of organizing this group of people, like you mentioned, called Strong Haulers. And I think the idea is to give people with long COVID resources to help to get the help that they need. A lot of times it's hard for people to find doctors that even are, you know, willing to listen to them and help them understand all these bizarre symptoms that they're experiencing. And for many people, you know, the treatment can look totally different depending on exactly what's causing your long COVID symptoms. So I think, you know, Ibrahim has been one of the people spearheading this effort. And I'm sure you can find more information about that online, but that's definitely one of the ways that people with long COVID can get help in order to sort of relieve the worst of their symptoms.
So we're talking about the COVID virus becoming a brain-body disorder. Have there ever been other viruses that have caused similar symptoms, or is this the first time we're really seeing this?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we do know that with other viruses, other viral infections, you can get these kind of post-viral syndromes, as they're called. So for example, people with chronic fatigue syndrome or ME/CFS, that disorder, we don't know the exact cause, but one hypothesis is that it is caused by a viral infection that triggers some kind of lingering syndrome. And it has a very similar presentation to long COVID. People have this extreme fatigue, this sort of exercise-induced malaise, and many other problems. So I think we can learn a lot from COVID about some of these other viral conditions and sort of that this may not be this may be a common occurrence with other viruses as well.
I wanted to ask you about Paxlovid and how it's being, there's an ongoing clinical trial using Paxlovid. And if I'm not mistaken, Paxlovid, you were able to get if you were a sort of a high-risk patient, you came down with COVID, you were able to get it. A lot of people, you know, older people that I knew chose not to because there were a lot of side effects, I think, from Paxlovid that, you know, it made people sort of shy away from it. But we're finding now that it's helpful, very helpful in not only treating long COVID, but also preventing from getting long COVID. What's the update on the research?
Yeah, so I think it's really unfortunate in some ways that many people got that message that Paxlovid either wasn't effective or that there were all these side effects, because what the data actually show is that Paxlovid is extremely effective at preventing severe COVID. And, you know, many people, you know, even if you were just slightly older or you had some underlying health condition, it really, you know, did benefit people to take it if they were eligible. But then, you know, in the terms of the side effects or the risk of rebound, I mean, those were all things that I think, you know, you have to weigh that against the risk of the disease itself, right? I mean, even if you had a rebound, most of the time that tended to be milder. So I think, you know, my general feeling is it's better to prevent the worst outcomes instead of worrying about something that may or may not happen down the road. So, and in terms of long COVID, though, you know, there have been studies showing that Paxlovid does seem to reduce the risk of developing long COVID, especially in some of these higher risk populations. So that's really good news. Just one more potential reason to want to take Paxlovid if you are in one of those higher risk groups, because, you know, nobody wants to be dealing with long COVID. So anything we can do to reduce that risk, even if it doesn't totally eliminate it, I think is still, you know, probably a good thing.
Yes. Tanya, before we let you go, I wanted to ask you, I mean, I know that you exist in a scientific community where real research is done and peer-reviewed articles are what you take your information on. And so the whole, you know, conspiracy theory world is not your world. But nevertheless, I'm wondering if we are, you know, as a group of humans, shifting what we believe about COVID. I just last night I was in a store and a gentleman who was a customer had a mask on, and he told the cashier that it was because he had COVID. And then when I got up to talk to the cashier, I said, isn't it interesting how we aren't so worried about, I mean, if there was someone coming in a store with COVID with a mask on, you know, 2 years ago or 3 years ago, we would have been absolutely freaked out. But now we just say, oh, well. And she proceeded to go on and spout some conspiracy theories that she knew to be true. And I thought, wow, isn't this interesting that it's these things are still persisting? What is your take on that?
Yeah, so unfortunately, I do think that the conspiracy world has come to me, whether or not I wanted it or not. I think that's been one of the biggest challenges of this pandemic and in communicating the science, is that there's so much misinformation. And, you know, many people are just seeking out information that they want to believe rather than, you know, kind of the truth, unfortunately. And so people have different versions of what they think is the truth. And it's just a real challenge to communicate what we do and don't know. And I think one additional part of that is that scientists themselves didn't understand everything. I still don't understand everything about this virus. You know, I mean, we're still unraveling all these mysteries about long COVID and how well these different treatments work and all of that. So I think having a bit of humility is helpful, and trying to approach things by telling people that, you know, we don't have all the answers, but this is the best evidence that we have, and this is what the science does tell us. And I think we can be reasonably confident that, you know, at this point in the pandemic, we do have a pretty good understanding of at least how this virus transmits, and what you can do to protect yourself, whether that's vaccination or taking Paxlovid or wearing a mask. And unfortunately, you know, there's going to be some people that we never reach, but at the end of the day, everyone has to sort of take the evidence for themselves and really look at what the evidence shows. So I hope that some people will at least keep their minds open to the science and the evidence, and that's the best we can hope for, because we want to keep people safe, and the more that we can do to help people educate themselves, I think the better.
And that was Tanya Lewis, Senior Editor of Health at Scientific American. Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City.